This is Writer's Voice, compelling conversations with authors who challenge, inspire, and inform. How free is the press, really? We begin with Andy Lee Roth of Project Censored, marking 50 years of tracking the most important stories the corporate media overlooks, from government surveillance of critics to social media censorship and the underreporting of police violence and the climate crisis. Then we turn to Michael Ellsberg, co-editor of Truth and Consequence, a powerful collection of writings by his father, Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg. The book asks a profound moral question. How do ordinary people become complicit in enormous harm? And what can they do to resist it? That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station, your favorite podcast app, or at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Fifty years after its founding, Project Censored continues to document the most important underreported stories in the U.S. media. Andy Lee Roth tells us how media consolidation, censorship by proxy, and algorithmic control are reshaping the information landscape. He highlights key censored stories, including ICE surveillance of critics, Meta's mass takedown of pro-Palestinian content, underreported police violence, and the climate crisis, which seems to have disappeared from the front pages of the corporate media. Roth also warns of growing threats to press freedom and emphasizes the vital role of independent journalism. Those and other stories are all in Project Censored's newest book, looking back at the least covered but critically important stories of the last year, State of the Free Press 2025. Oh, and a note to listeners, both Roth and I occasionally mixed up the title, calling it State of the Free Press 2026. But that book will be out next year. Let's listen to our conversation now. Welcome back to Writer's Voice, Andy Lee Roth.
Thanks so much, Francesca. It's a pleasure to join you again.
So this is really exciting. This is the 50th anniversary of Project Censored with the State of the Free Press 2026. 50 years in, what has changed most about censorship of the press and what hasn't?
It's easy to talk about the continuities, I think. We still have the reality of a corporate-controlled press that is the majority of the news that most Americans encounter, whether it's through their social media feeds or on television or in print. And there still is a robust independent press, but it's shaded out by the massive platform and bright lights of the corporate version of reporting in the 21st century. So that challenge, I think, has been a constant since Carl Jensen founded Project Censored in 1976. Some new things. Wow, it's hard to summarize changes, but a watershed moment was the 1996 Telecommunications Act, which basically opened the door for yet more consolidation of media ownership. And we know all too well now, I'm speaking to you as a sociologist, so I think about these power dynamics, right, that a narrow range of ownership leads to a narrow range of perspectives, right? So the ownership has a direct relationship to the content. And so if you think back, I think 96 is one watershed. Thinking more recently, the last couple of years, my Project Censored colleagues and I, in particular, Mickey Huff, the director of the project, and Avram Anderson, colleague of ours who's a library information science expert at Cal State University Northridge, have been talking about censorship by proxy as a new form of censorship that involves collusion between government entities who are the normal, for most Americans, censorship by government is what people think of when they think of the First Amendment. And a lot of people in the U.S. don't realize that the First Amendment doesn't restrict corporate censorship in any way. So censorship by proxy is this kind of more recent development whereby corporate entities, especially in our current context, big tech companies, are in effect doing the dirty work of the government, not necessarily on behest of the government, but hand in glove with, because they're each pursuing mutually beneficial interests. And that's a relatively new development, I think, in terms of how big tech is shaping information ecosystems and freedom of expression and freedom of information.
And even more intensely, that's happening now directly with news organizations. We have CBS. Paramount is about to, who are they going to buy?
Yes, the players are hard to keep track of. But the gist is, I mean, this is something that Ben Bagdikian warned about in the early 80s in his book Media Monopoly, and that we've seen, you know, in the lifespan of Project Censored, we've seen the chickens coming home to roost, that more and more consolidation. In this case now, it's heavily, heavily and almost overtly politicized, that Ellison and others of these big owners are not even trying to play their cards to their vest about their interest in paying fealty to the Trump administration and Donald Trump. And so some of these efforts to further consolidate ownership are, I think, overtly political at this point, in a way that maybe they might not have been in the past, even though they would have always had political implications.
Exactly. So now let's talk about some of the top censored stories of 2024 to 2025. And speaking of which, I mean, we're going to talk a lot about what we've just referred to. One of the top stories involves ICE soliciting social media surveillance contracts to identify critics. This is chilling.
Yeah. And we know a lot about ICE now, and the world doesn't stop for Project Censored to take the state of the free press temperature. But this is a story that was originally reported almost a year ago by Sam Biddle of The Intercept, by Brett Wilkins of Common Dreams, and Ariana Bio of The Independent. And what Biddle and Wilkins did for their original reporting was to look at lengthy requests for bids from contractors by ICE to monitor threats and criticism directed against ICE officials. The documents cited increased threats to immigration and customs agents and leaderships as justification for this expanded digital surveillance. And the call for proposals was about contractors monitoring social media content for anything that ICE deemed to be a content creator's proclivity for violence. I'm putting that in quotes. And that those should be assessed. These are according, again, to the bids for contracts, according to social and behavioral sciences, psychological profiles of the posters and such. We know so much now about how ICE agents have been endangering and in some cases ending the lives of citizens. And it's perhaps surprising to think that ICE considers itself embattled enough that they have to monitor and locate any negative social media discussion of the agency on social media platforms. Cynthia Rodriguez, who works with the Latinx rights group Mejente, told The Intercept, ICE's attempts to have eyes and ears in as many places as we exist, online and offline, should ring an alarm for all of us. But again, this story is placed prominently on our story list in the 2026 yearbook, because when we dug for corporate news media coverage of ICE's proposed surveillance of its critics on social media, we found next to nothing. Forbes and the New York Times have both covered ICE's investment of millions of dollars in other digital surveillance technologies, but they had nothing to say about the reports that originated with The Intercept and Common Dreams and The Independent.
Hasn't it gotten worse now, in fact, that they're just routinely surveilling social media of, you know, they're linking facial recognition with social media posts, as well as other things. I mean, what does this say? It's a kind of merging of state power and digital surveillance.
Exactly. And that's, you know, going back to, I mentioned this idea of censorship by proxy earlier. Here's a case where social media outlets operating like aware of this, the chilling effect of that, both on the social media platforms for what kind of content they'll allow under so-called community standards, and then for any savvy users who realize, like, well, if I post something on my social, that will be subject potentially to ICE surveillance and monitoring. The same, you know, this is the online version of what we know, like one of the effects, I think one of the intended effects of kind of militarized law enforcement presence at legitimate First Amendment protected demonstrations is to convince people that they should stay home and not participate. And this is the online version of that, I think. The chilling effects are real.
People have even been arrested for things they posted on social media that was not violent in the least. And further in that vein, let's talk about the crackdown by Meta on Facebook and Instagram posts at Israel's request. This raises really profound questions about the power of these platforms. Tell us about that story.
Francesca, thanks for asking about this. This is one of my favorite stories from this year's list. It fits a type of story that shows up with some regularity at Project Censored. It's in effect a censored story about censorship. So the story here was broken by DropSite News in April of last year. Meta workers leaked to DropSite News a trove of documents, internal company data that was compiled and provided by whistleblowers from Meta, showing that since October of 2023, Meta, which owns Facebook and Instagram, had acted on 94% of the Israeli government's requests for so-called TDRs, takedown requests, to take down posts on those platforms that were critical of Israel or even vaguely supportive of Palestinians, as DropSite News reported. DropSite News characterized Meta's response to the takedown request campaign as the largest mass censorship operation in modern history. That's kind of melodramatic sounding, but what we're talking about here is some 38.8 million posts that were either removed, banned, or suppressed. Posts from people living in countries all over the world. And as DropSite News pointed out, this censorship project, Israel's censorship project, is going to echo into the future because, of course, Meta is training AI programs to do content moderation. And those AI programs are trained on this pre-filtered, censored spectrum of posts. You know, basically, Meta, as the Council on American-Islamic Relations stated in a press release condemning Meta's actions, Meta must stop censoring criticism of the Israeli government under the guise of combating anti-Semitism, and Meta must stop training artificial intelligence tools to do so.
Well, you know, the irony of this is that people so much complain, and I think rightfully so, of the lack of content moderation against right-wing posts that spread hate and disinformation. So I wonder if you could pose these two apparently opposite and yet functionally similar practices.
Well, I mean, I think one of the things, one of the allures of AI and the algorithms that drive AI is the notion they're objective. This is what Patrick Soon-Shiong, the billionaire owner of the LA Times, likes to talk about, that how he's reforming the Los Angeles Times using AI tools. But he's one of many people, both owners and people in journalism, who are attracted to this allure that it takes out the human subjective element. And human judgment can be flawed, no doubt. But I think what you see when you look at something like the DropSite News report about Meta's sweeping crackdown, or you look at ICE soliciting surveillance contracts to identify critics on social media, is that these algorithms are not neutral. And they aren't objective in the sense of that term that people are thinking when they're thinking of AI and algorithmic tools in positive, uncritical terms. And so the powers that be, whether they're the people developing these programs or whether they're people who have influence in how those programs are utilized, we see this as, you know, another way where technology reflects and reproduces power dynamics that exist in the broader society.
So Andy Lee Roth, in this 50 years of Project Censored, this 50-year anniversary volume of Project Censored and the State of the Free Press 2025, You also mention again, as you have in the past, the underreported abuses of police authority. And what's so striking about this is that the horrific murders of Renee Good and Alex Preti were reported, of course. But it put me in mind of, wow, I haven't heard of too many reports of the killing of unarmed black men really since 2020. I wonder, has that really gone down? And then I looked it up and no, it's actually gone up. There have been more murders of unarmed black men, and yet we don't know about them.
This is a good time for me to say, because I won't be able to do justice to our number 8 story about the underreported, often deadly abuses of police authority in the time that we have. But all these stories are not only in the Project Censored yearbook, they are online at the Project Censored website, projectcensored.org. But on this story, one of our reports here is from Truthout. Sharon Zhang's report on the U.S. police killed someone every 6.5 hours on average in 2024. This is data from the group mapping police violence. 2024 was the deadliest year since the group began recording data in 2013. Black and indigenous people were disproportionately targeted. Mapping police violence found only 10 days in 2024 when police did not kill one in the United States. As if that's not chilling enough, the part that really gets me is that 65% of the police killings that mapping police violence documented were in response to 911 calls. As Truthout reported, the majority happened when police were responding to nonviolent offenses. So it's worth noting that this story has received some corporate news coverage. In February of 2025, the USA Today used data from mapping police violence for a report on demographic patterns in police killings. And in May of 2025, the New York Times sourced data from mapping police violence in a report about how police killings are actually rising, not falling, as you noted a moment ago, since the murder of George Floyd by a Minneapolis police officer in 2020. So this story hasn't been completely blockaded by the corporate press, but arguably, given the significance of the story, it has also nonetheless been underreported by those outlets.
Another kind of reporting that has drastically fallen off, it seems to me. We know that the Washington Post fired its entire climate desk is the climate catastrophe that only gets worse. So one story is about the Antarctic ice sheets, which are approaching a tipping point. I mean, that will see tens of feet of rise of sea level, yet it barely penetrates a corporate news cycle. Why is climate breakdown disappearing from the news?
I think there are a couple reasons. So this is me in a more speculative mode now for the why aren't they? I think one is there's an effort by the Trump administration to make this a non-issue, to treat this as, oh, well, this is just like DEI. It's some agenda of the radical left that wants to undermine America. I think the other thing is that there's a challenge for scientists and for science reporting to convey to the public that when there are new findings, they aren't just kind of additive, more of the same. And so the two stories that we focus on the Antarctic ice sheets in State of the Free Press 2026 and the tipping point, Robert Hunziker's story for Counterpunch and Matthew Rosa reporting for Salon are about increases in open ocean temperatures, pushing marine ice sheets past a tipping point that could trigger what one of the scientific reports calls runaway melting. And I'm not an expert on the science of this, Francesca, but what we're talking about here is warm water coming in and actually undercutting these massive sheets. And previous studies of rising sea levels and declining ice levels haven't taken into account this undercutting effect. And when scientists now take this into account, it basically leads them to conclude that everything they've been warning us about is now happening on an even faster pace. So why isn't that story covered? I think part of it is it's not good news for business as usual. And also there is a sense of, oh, well, didn't we already know that? A kind of jadedness. And obviously, by featuring this story prominently in our annual report of the most important but underreported stories, we're hoping to buck that trend and galvanize people into renewed concern about the climate, because it is a crisis, right? I mean, we get used to calling it a climate crisis, maybe, but that word crisis should stand out and should have the impact on us that it does.
And the final story I'm going to ask you about is the underrepresentation of working class people in state legislatures. In other words, the incredible income inequality between our rulers and the ruled.
This is a great one. And it might speak to, if I could editorialize for a moment, it might be part of the puzzle, one piece of the puzzle of why there isn't action on the climate crisis, because who will bear the greatest brunt of the climate crisis? But to speak to this story in particular, the finding is that the working class is severely underrepresented in state legislatures. The reporting was done by Robbie Sequeira for Stateline, and that reporting was based on a joint study, a biennial study by Duke University and Loyola University Chicago researchers, who found that just 1.6% of state lawmakers in the U.S. are considered working class, compared to, depending on how you count working class, basically 50% of all participants in the American labor force. So just 116 of nearly 7,400 state legislatures in the U.S. come from working class backgrounds. The same issue that I was talking about earlier in our conversation, a lack of diversity in that representation is going to, in this case, lead probably to a lack of policy and legislation that reflects the interests, the actual interests, not the propagandized interests of working class people. Of course, this is happening at the same time that this problem of the working class underrepresentation isn't really confined only to state legislatures. We know from data from Open Secrets that the 116th Congress featured an astonishing number of people who were millionaires. The 10 richest members of Congress in 2020 had an estimated fortunes in excess of $30 million. So the wealth inequality that I think characterizes the United States and that was in some sense exposed by the COVID pandemic is also evident in our legislative bodies. This is another story where there's been no, to the best of our search abilities, there's been no national corporate news coverage of the study on the class background of state legislatures. We found a couple of op-ed pieces in the Washington Post and the New York Times, but no hard news coverage of this, even though these are demonstrable facts.
And we should repeat again that all of these stories can be read online. And give us the website again.
At projectcensored.org.
Now, talk about the attacks on journalism. You know, we know that Trump has famously called the press the enemies of the people. Don Lemon is just perhaps the most high-profile case of attacks on journalists who cover the news that Trump regime doesn't want you to know about. You document a wave of violence against journalists covering protests and DOJ threats of prosecution. Talk about the threat to press freedom right now.
Well, we know that hateful rhetoric leads to violent action. And that's most evident, I think, in terms of the number of deaths of journalists in the line of duty in Gaza. And the Committee to Protect Journalists documents those figures. And I would urge anyone who's interested in thorough documentation of attacks on journalists, not symbolic attacks, but physical attacks, arrests, detentions, taking away of cameras and other reporting equipment, and then ultimately the killing of journalists. The Committee to Protect Journalists keeps thorough records. Thinking domestically, the same could be said of the U.S. Press Freedom Tracker, which meticulously documents assaults on journalists, arrests of journalists, damage to journalists' equipment. And although we fortunately haven't had a journalist killed in the line of duty in the United States for a few years now, but that's still a concern. So this is part of a larger attack, I think, that we're witnessing right now. What's happening to journalists is part of a larger attack that you could think of as being, I'll use a fancy term here, a kind of attack on all of our epistemic institutions, where epistemology refers to not only what we know, but how we know it. And so if you think of epistemic institutions, they include things like the field of journalism, which is how most of us know what we know about what's happening in the world and in our country. But epistemic institutions would also include educational environments, college and university classrooms, like where Project Censored students are digging and vetting these stories, but also high schools and middle schools and on down into the K through sixth grades, where the freedom to teach and what books can be assigned and therefore what students can learn about and whether they can see themselves reflected in the texts that they're learning from. All these are under attack with the Trump administration. And that could probably be a whole conversation in its own right. But I would just say, you know, I think one of the challenges here, going back specifically to attacks on journalists, is that, of course, press freedom is a concern for all journalists, but it's often covered as a sidebar to other stories. Journalists are taught in J school not to make themselves the center of the story. But I have this image of, you know, the old Looney Tunes cartoons where the circular saw was in operation. You know, so it's the Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote trying to demolish each other. And one of them is standing on a wooden floor and the other is underneath. You can't see them, but you see the blade of their saw circling around them. And the image I kind of have, and I've been talking about this with journalists at journalism conferences around the country this past year, is right now there Wile E. Coyote standing on that floorboard as the Trump administration and corporate entities that share the same interests are in effect sawing the floorboards out from underneath them. And if journalists don't start talking about the conditions necessary to do their work, at some point that saw will complete its revolution and they will simply disappear down the hole. So a fanciful Looney Tunes cartoon image for a very serious problem. Press freedom should be a concern for everyone, but the public won't fully understand it until journalists start reporting on it as a story in its own right and not a sidebar.
Well, I couldn't agree more. On the other hand, it does seem that there is a real renaissance in the I wouldn't call it the alternate press, but in the free press. You know, Don Lemon being an example there himself. I mean, he left CNN, and now he's on YouTube. So many other writers, a lot of journalists who were let go by the Washington Post now have their Substacks. Now, that's not alternative media or the free press outlets that you talk about, but I've noticed that as these established or former corporate journalists go independent, they tend to be a lot more interesting in their coverage.
Yeah, because maybe now they're free. It's worth saying, I think there are a lot of journalists with amazing integrity and a serious sense of commitment to the ethical conduct of their profession working in corporate newsrooms. But again, the sociologist in me understands, like, when you're an individual in an organization, you quickly learn to adapt what you do to the demands of that organization, or you won't be a functioning member of that organization for very long, right? That's the pressures on journalists with integrity and commitment to public service who work in these settings. That said, kind of circling back to something from the beginning of our conversation, I think one thing I would say 50 years into Project Censored is we actually are in a golden era of independent journalism right now. And we'll continue to be as long as we have a free and open internet and the platform that that provides people to reach audiences. I know a lot of people have shifted to Substack. I know that there are now some concerns about Substack as a platform. Project Censored, Mickey Huff and I wrote about that a little bit a few years ago. Again, because any of these platforms that are run by private entities as for-profit businesses are subject to their own pressures. But nonetheless, independent journalists are finding ways to keep doing the work in the face of all these threats, symbolic and physical. I would just give a shout out here to and alert your audience to anyone who doesn't know about the Movement Media Alliance, This was founded by a number of people, but the ones I'm most familiar with are some of the leaders from Truthout. The Movement Media Alliance is, I think, 30-some independent news organizations that have basically linked arms and said, we're going to provide each other mutual aid to get through these tough times and make sure that our voices continue to be heard. And I think it's a really inspiring group. Project Censored is a member of the Movement Media Alliance, but we joined because it made total sense to us. And I've been so impressed by what the Alliance has been able to accomplish in the couple of years that it's been in existence. So we actually have in our Media Democracy in Action chapter an article about the Movement Media Alliance by two of its founders, Maya Shinwar and Lara Witt. And they have one of my favorite quotes from the whole book in their article about the Movement Media Alliance as an example of media democracy in action. Maya and Lara say, there's no power for the people without journalism by and for the people.
Well, this has just been a fascinating conversation about the most important stories that have been underreported or unreported in the corporate media. Project Censored's book, State of the Free Press 2026. Andy Lee Roth, thank you so much for telling us about it, talking about it with us. And we want to reiterate again that any of our listeners can go to projectcensored.org to read these stories. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Andy Lee Roth. Go to writersvoice.net to find links to the State of the Free Press 2025, where you can read all the stories we talked about today and more. Next, a gripping conversation with Daniel Ellsberg's son, Michael, about his father's legacy and what it has to teach us in our perilous times today. Stay tuned after a short break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to listen again, like, and subscribe to the podcast. It really helps to get the word out about the show. Henry Kissinger called Daniel Ellsberg the most dangerous man in America when Ellsberg released the Pentagon Papers in 1971. That's ironic, because Kissinger was an inveterate warmonger, whereas Ellsberg became dedicated to promoting peace after the crisis of conscience that turned him from a Defense Department analyst to one who played a key role in helping to end the Vietnam War. From nuclear war planning to Vietnam and after, Ellsberg's life traced a path from insider to dissident. That trajectory urged him to ask a profound moral question. How do ordinary people become complicit in enormous harm, and what can they do to resist it? His questions resonate with urgency today. As the U.S. and Israel carry out military operations against Iran, and as Israel's wars in Gaza and Lebanon continue with devastating civilian tolls, Ellsberg's insistence on confronting the human consequences of war and the systems that enable it feels less like history and more like a warning. In 2026 alone, large-scale U.S. and Israeli strikes on Iran have destroyed both military targets and killed thousands of civilians, while regional conflicts have displaced millions and escalated across borders. Ellsberg's challenge was always this: not just what governments do, but what citizens are willing to see and what they're willing to do about it. And he came up with a key, hopeful finding, that moral courage is not rare, and it's contagious. Michael Ellsberg joins us to talk about Truth and Consequence, a powerful collection of writings by his father, which he co-edited. Let's listen now. Michael Ellsberg, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited for our conversation.
Truth and Consequence. This is a collection that brings together personal essays, notebook reflections, moral philosophy from your father, Daniel Ellsberg, spanning roughly 50 years. Tell us just a little bit about how this project came about.
So there are two co-editors, myself and Jan Thomas, who was Dan's longtime assistant and who I've known since I was five. And both of us had the idea that my father had a lot of writing that was really good that hadn't reached the public yet. And but there was just so much good stuff that he hadn't published yet. And I was more focused on these personal essays he had written that he wanted out and that had never been published. And Jan was more focused on these roughly 100 boxes of yellow pad notes. I mean, literally boxes jammed filled with steno notes, yellow pads, that are now housed at the UMass Amherst Library. And Jan's vision was that she should go through those and find the best parts. And my vision was that I should go through his computer files that have tons and tons of interesting writing that he didn't get out. And we both decided, you know, we should do this. And we did get my father's permission before he passed. And we can talk about that. He doesn't have a history of being like super thrilled that all his sort of raw ideas get out. So I can't say he was wild about the idea, but we were wild about it. And he did give us permission. So we stand by what's in the book.
And I think in this case, you guys had the right idea.
Yeah. His writing, especially the notebooks, they're so fascinating, but he viewed writing notes as an activity in and of itself. He didn't really care that anyone read these. And I think he wouldn't have written them had he been expecting others to read them. So we had a loving disagreement on that one with him, but he did go our way, and we're glad with it.
This collection is so pertinent right now as the doomsday clock goes ever more closer to midnight because of the kinds of adventurous and insane wars that are going on. The central question, the central moral puzzle of the collection is how ordinary, decent people end up participating in enormous evil, from war to nuclear planning. And of course, he was a nuclear planner at one time, and he was part of the planning for the Vietnam War. And then, as we all know, he became a whistleblower, and he had a huge role in stopping that war. What did he learn about how ordinary, decent people end up participating in enormous evil?
Well, that's a great question, because he learned it the hard way. He writes in one of his notes here that he came to be a part of two systems, two projects that he later came to view as evil and as wrongheaded as you can be. One is the planning for hundreds of millions of civilians to be killed if general nuclear war plans were activated against the Soviet Union. And then the other, less earth-shattering, but still a horrible moral crime, was Vietnam. And he got pulled into both of these in different ways. And his key question in both of these instances is, what do you do as an official when you realize that the policy that you are enacting is crazy or immoral or evil? And his point is that any plan where, if executed successfully, such as a nuclear war plans that would kill 100 times 600 million people across the Russia and China bloc, so 100 times the Holocaust, that there just is no word for that type of intentional destruction other than evil. It stretches our vocabulary, it stretches our moral concepts even to contemplate such a thing. And yet there he was in these bureaucracies coolly and rationally going forth with different plans around this kind of stuff. So the book really is a meditation, a reflection on what you should do, what we should all do when we're part of organizations that are doing horrible, wrongheaded, disastrous things. And that's what he spent 50 years reflecting on.
So let's talk about some of the ways in which that kind of complicity happens and how it gets undone. Let's talk a little bit about his personal turning point, which really came with the Vietnam War. He wrote that early in his career, he was willing to risk his life to help the U.S. win the Vietnam War. But later, he was willing to risk prison to help end it. What changed in his understanding of the war that led him to understand its evil? And how did he come to understand his own responsibility to take action against it?
Yeah, so there were two main threads that got him to change his action around Vietnam. One was going in the field. He had been a Marine company commander in the 50s. He didn't see combat as a commander. He went to Vietnam as an analyst for the State Department and Defense Department, but he was an observer, a civilian observer, but he did carry a weapon in the front lines as he was observing. It's pretty upfront observing. And he came to believe that the war was totally stalemated, that there was essentially no way that we were going to win this war with troops, no matter how many troops we sent there. And there was no win available for us. And that was a pretty widely shared view on the ground. And his job was to get that view to the bureaucracy, to the Pentagon. It turned out that was a fairly widely shared view within the Pentagon. And even McNamara more or less believed that this was going to be very difficult, if not impossible, to win the way we were going. And what my father noticed was that the public was being lied about this, that the public was being told, just send this one more batch of troops and, you know, we're winning and we're making all this progress and the kill lists and all that. And my father came to view this as profoundly anti-democratic, that the public was being asked to send their sons. At that time, I think it wasn't daughters as much. Now it's sons and daughters. But sending their sons to war and to die and to kill and be killed, plus tremendous amounts of taxpayer dollars, plus cleavages throughout the whole society in every kind of different direction. And we're being asked to do that under just bold-faced lies. The second thread was when he was part of writing the Pentagon Papers. He was one of 35 authors of the Pentagon Papers under McNamara. And at that point, he read the origins of the war, and he realized that essentially there was no legitimate purpose for us being there. This had been a colonial effort of the French, and we were more or less just involved in a pretty straightforward colonial imperial war, you know, determining the affairs of other nations. Does that unfortunately sound familiar now? And that people were being lied into war. And he decided that this was a matter of, you know, democratic governance and that the public needed to know why they were being asked to make these sacrifices. So that's why he decided to share what he knew.
And one of the threads in this collection, Truth and Consequence, Reflections on Catastrophe, Civil Resistance, and Hope, that you've put together of your father, Daniel Ellsberg's work, Michael Ellsberg, is that in a bureaucracy, it's more important to pretend that you're winning, to say that you're winning, than actually win. He spoke about a bureaucratic conscience. So unpack that for us. What is it about bureaucracies that tend to continue these disastrous policies even when they know they're not working?
Great question. One of the key points in the book that comes again and again in this book is that there's a massive split in the concept of conscience as it applies to individuals or, let's say, small group situations, communities, families, versus large bureaucratic organizations, and they mean almost exact opposite things. So when we talk about our conscience in an everyday life, we're talking about playground stuff. Don't lie, don't cheat, don't steal, don't hit people without, you know, strong self-defense reasons. These type of things that we've internalized since we were children and hopefully still are active for us. And when you get in a large bureaucratic organization, conscience means almost the opposite. There's a different set of values that gets enacted and encouraged, which is follow the leader, follow orders, don't question. Above all, don't bring any type of criticism or shame on the organization. And there's often encouragement or even viewing it as a good thing to lie to people outside of the organization, to mislead, to deceive. So my father writes a lot about how conscience can actually lead you astray in an organization if your conscience is telling you that you need to just blindly follow orders. And if your individual conscience tells you this is actually wrong and this is deceitful, this is lying, this is harmful to the public. So these are two really different contexts. And one point he makes very strongly is that the vast majority of harm in the world is perpetuated by organizations. You know, different countries have different crime rates, but in general, murder is a fairly rare thing, fortunately, and it's newsworthy. But organizations, the amount of homicide perpetuated by organizations just dwarfs the individual amount. And if you look at the reasons for those homicides, they're usually not very good. And so my father would say that when you have bad reasons to kill people, and they weren't immediately urgent self-defense, he would call that murder. And it's a strong word, but he makes the case strongly in the book.
He does. And he actually even extends it beyond physical immediate violence, as in war, to the kind of mass murder that is created by, let's say, income inequality or pollution.
Yeah, those weren't as much his focus, but he saw all of these as part of a system, and the global reigning system of capitalism. Although he wasn't a fan of the Soviet Union either, so he wasn't like some ideologue about some other system, but he would see how all these systems would come together and generally promote the interests of the insiders with a kind of omerta, secrecy, mafia-like morality towards the outsiders.
Daniel Ellsberg was also influenced by the experiments of Stanley Milgram. Maybe say a little bit about those experiments and why did they have such a great impact on him?
So these are some of the most famous experiments in the history of psychology by Stanley Milgram. I'm not exactly sure the dates on that. So I'm not an expert, but I grew up hearing about this so much that I can recreate, my dad's thoughts on it. But the basic experiment was they brought test subjects in, everyday people that they recruited, and they told them that you're going to be part of some kind of experiment where people are getting tested with little electroshocks and how that impacts their test taking or their memorization or something like that. Now, what the test subjects didn't know was that the other people on the other side of these shocks were actors, or as they call it, confederates. They were part of the study and they weren't the random people being recruited. And so what would happen is they would ask the test subjects, they'd say, okay, now you need to administer the test. And when the other person gets it wrong, you press this button and it gives them a shock. And the shock machine, there's pictures of this, had a dial. I don't think it was quite this extreme, but it looked pretty foreboding. It was like, okay, red zone, like danger, extreme danger, with different settings of the dial. And the real experiment was not about test taking and electroshocks. It was about how far would someone go under orders. So they would give the test, the Confederate would get the thing wrong, the test subject would press the button, and they were in a separate room, so all they could hear is the voice. So they piped in this fake acting voice saying, ah, screaming, and the screams would get louder with these shocks, and the test subjects, you know, this is just the average person off the street is increasingly alarmed at these shocks. And the key point is the test administrator would say, you know, you must go on. It's imperative that the tests continue. And some huge amount of people just kept going and following orders to administer these shocks, even to the point where basically the person on the other line was saying, like, I'm dying, I'm dying. So, you know, it was a pretty disturbing result. And what my father took from that, and many people did, is that people will completely override their own morality, which says, don't shock people. That's a pretty common moral principle. Don't electrocute people. We'll just totally press pause on that if they're being ordered to do so by some authority figure. So he really saw his own complicity in immoral policies as being explained by that and many others as well.
And those were shocking experiments, but he also talked another part of it. We could say that the Milgram experiments were about the perpetrators, whereas they're also the bystanders to atrocities. And Father Daniel Ellsberg wrote about the strong tendency of people to need not to know, prefer ignorance about what their governments are doing. Talk a little bit about that and then maybe weigh in whether you think anything has changed about that more recently.
Yeah, well, there's a pretty obvious example that unfortunately is now, you know, across our fields now with the destruction of this school in Iran. And it seems to be more and more clear that the U.S. military struck this, and I would assume they weren't intending to hit a school, but apparently they thought it was, you know, somehow connected to this military installation, and they did target the building. And so something like 175 school kids, I guess mostly girls, maybe it was a girls' school, were killed. And my father would say murdered, because this was a reckless war. It's a war of choice. It's a war that we didn't need to fight to be repelling immediate attacks on our country or our troops. And you're just obliterating an entire school. I mean, my elementary school had about 175 roughly in it. And so I'm just imagining my whole school just gone one minute to the next. Now, you can argue about, you know, why we're doing this war and if it's good to get rid of this regime. And I think people across a wide spectrum would say that this is a horrible regime and that it should be out one way or another. But if we're going to have this debate society-wide, we should be debating what the costs are. And it's quite obvious that the costs are a tremendous toll on the civilians of Iran or any nation that we're bombing. And like, why isn't this front page news? Like, why? I mean, this is horrendous. This is just absolutely horrendous. And it should be splayed across the news. And we're barely hearing a thing about it. And, you know, not that it would be good to be seeing these, you know, bloody pictures, but I think a little bit more of a visual of what the type of destruction we're creating would allow us to make better choices about, you know, what's being done in our name. So I think that's a perfect example of how I think a lot of people, especially in the media, are just kind of preferring to memory hole the fact that an entire elementary school was just obliterated by our forces.
And not to speak of the decades of the Epstein class not saying anything or looking the other way. And actually, what you're talking about here leads to another important idea that Daniel Ellsberg explored in his writings as collected in this book, Truth and Consequence. And that is the moral absolute. He has an essay against terrorism. He said that the deliberate killing of civilians must never be justified, whether by states or insurgents. Talk a little bit about that, because, of course, you know, the U.S. Army could say, well, this was collateral damage, and it was right next to a military installation, so we had to do it.
So the core principle of the book, and I actually highlighted this in my introduction because I wanted it to be front and center there, is what he regards as an absolute, which is do not deliberately target civilians. And that is the definition of terrorism. Like when we talk about other forces committing terrorism, that's what we're talking about, that they intended for civilians to die. And his big point is that by that definition, which is kind of hard to argue with, I mean, that's literally the definition of it, we were the greatest terrorists in the atomic bomb in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, these intense, deliberate targeting of mass destruction of civilians. And that our nuclear plans, though fortunately not enacted yet after that, are terrorist plans because they deliberately target civilian populations. Now, it gets a little bit more complicated when you're in a war. Collateral damage happens, death to civilians that was not intended as such. And at that point, it really does matter if this war is absolutely necessary or not. If you're fighting a war because your nation is immediately under attack, then probably some civilians on the other side are going to die while you're fighting that war. But if you're fighting a war of choice that is not necessary, that has not been authorized by Congress, that the public doesn't want, that the public is not begging for, on the contrary, then when you're engaging in what amounts to just wildly reckless disregard for the civilian population on the other side, even if I would hope they weren't trying to kill school children, but they were trying to destroy the building and they had faulty intelligence, it's just a level of reckless disregard for the civilian population that he would regard as a moral evil and that just can't be contemplated no matter what ideals or purpose or whatever we think that we're achieving over there.
Yeah, and it does get complicated in a way because you can say on the one hand, well, this is not a war of choice and it's clear the evil that is involved. But then I think of World War II, where people organized resistance to the Nazis and they deliberately, well, they weren't civilians. I guess maybe that would be the key. Would that be the difference, that if you're fighting in an insurgency and you're targeting the military, it's not the same as targeting civilians?
Yeah. So my father was generally considered a leftist or a man of the left, and that was his milieu after the Pentagon Papers. He was not a revolutionary Marxist or revolutionary the way a lot of people on the left were, especially in the 60s and 70s. He was more in the tradition of nonviolent civil disobedience, Thoreau, Gandhi, Martin Luther King. And so he lost some friends on the left because, you know, a lot of people on the left are very romantic about, you know, the revolution and guerrilla fighters. And they're often quite willing to excuse the deliberate targeting of civilians on their side. And my father was very strict on that point, is that he would, you know, even if the cause was fair or just or repelling, attackers or repelling imperialists or whatever it may be, he felt that as soon as you cross that line into deliberately targeting civilians on the other side, you had whatever you were fighting for was no longer worth it. Because one of his favorite quotes was from Nietzsche, who said, if you stare into the abyss, the abyss stares back into you. As soon as you're deliberately targeting civilians on the other side or just recklessly endangering their lives, whatever ideals that you hold for yourself have just been completely sullied. So it's already a loss before any other loss of life.
So let's talk about civil disobedience or whistleblowing or any of the kind of nonviolent resistance that he called for. In fact, Daniel Ellsberg said that he felt that it could only have been the civic activism of the population that could end the Vietnam War. And I think it did, although, of course, insiders like himself were the other key part of that. He made a very interesting difference between hope and optimism. And I wonder if you could go into that as a way of, into this conversation about civic responsibility.
So he was definitely not an optimistic person. I grew up with a very pessimistic father, which I've had to, you know, come to terms with that philosophy myself. He told me that he thought it would be a miracle if humanity survived into 2100 because of the nuclear and how risky it still is to have all these nuclear weapons on hair trigger alert. So he was not optimistic about our chances, and he was not religious, so he was not a person of faith. But he did say, "I'm a person of hope." And what he meant by that was something very specific, which is that many historical events in life seemed miraculous. No one was expecting the fall of the Berlin Wall, the end of the Cold War, especially not with, you know, major conflict. And he viewed that as a kind of miracle, a social political miracle. And there were others as well, including the fall of the apartheid. That seemed like that could just go on forever. And there are many things like that where there is uncertainty. You can have predictions that things are very likely to go wrong. And that was his prediction in many ways. But still know that you're not 100% on that. And even if there's that 1% or 5% chance that things go better, you should orient towards that and proceed as if that was a possibility to steer things in that direction.
He says that democracy itself implies a shared moral responsibility, and that resistance to tyranny, we could say, or to evil, is not merely political. It's ethical and spiritual. So talk just briefly about how he saw a connection between political action and stewardship, the religious concept of stewardship.
Yeah, I think that the spiritual, moral side of this comes when we contemplate these type of the tremendous amount of suffering in the civilian population. That to just treat that as numbers on a spreadsheet is wrong. That these are human beings. These are human beings, and we are, you know, inflicting tremendous amount of suffering on the families and the grieving families, and that you can't just evaluate that in cost-benefit terms. You have to evaluate it in the question of who have I become? Who have we become? Who has our nation become if this is what we are inflicting on other people? And a pretty good test of that, which he had shared with me at different times, I don't know if it's in the book, is just imagine doing the other side doing it to you. What would you think of that side? You know, if Iran bombs an elementary school here, what would we be saying about Iran? We would be calling them evil and horrendous and terrorists. Well, unfortunately, that is now how we are being seen by large parts of the world when we do this kind of thing. And so there has to be a moral dimension to it. Morality doesn't just go out the window when as soon as your national defense apparatus has been activated. It's still activated by humans, and humans have moral sensibility, moral obligation, moral duty, not to inflict tremendous suffering on people a planet away.
And he also said that moral courage is contagious. And I think we've all had the experience of that as we see the shining example of the people of Minneapolis.
Yes, he felt very much. I grew up hearing, your father is my hero. Your father is my hero. And, you know, people told him he was their hero. And his attitude towards that concept was he was fine with that label as long as it was understood to mean something that he had done something accessible to a very wide range of people. So he did not believe that he was some, you know, special moral person on planet Earth, or that he had some kind of special moral powers or elevation. And in fact, he was, you know, he was very aware of a lot of his flaws as a person. But he also felt that when the time calls and when your ideals are on the line, when your nation is on the line, that people can be very courageous and heroic in the battlefield, firefighters saving people from buildings, this type of heroism. And there's also civic heroism when your country is at risk, your country's ideals, and people can take risks that may have some real risk for their lives in defense of their country, just as people take those risks on the battlefield or with burning buildings and such.
And so finally, Michael Ellsberg, how has working on this project, this collection of your father's writings, how has this deepened your understanding of him and even perhaps changed you?
It was really meaningful to me. I write in the introduction that his main activity in life that I observed him doing, I was born in 77, was essentially writing these notes. He just loved reading and writing detailed marginalia and then writing notes in these legal pads. And I didn't have a lot of access to this activity because his writing, his handwriting is almost inscrutable. It's the most bizarre, hard to read handwriting I've seen. And I literally would need him to read his birthday cards that he wrote for me. But fortunately, Jan Thomas could read his writing, and she put tremendous amount of energy into selecting, editing, transcribing these 100 boxes of notes. So for me, it was very moving seeing the thoughts come to life. It's like, you know, in a dark room where you put the thing under the chemical and boom, all of a sudden this blank page has an image on it. And that's what it felt like to me, to see this activity of 50 years of note-taking and my whole life brought to life. And there's so many gems in there. There's just these pithy insights or these turns of phrase or just ways of thinking about things that are very counterintuitive, but that make sense as soon as you see it, that would have been, I think, lost to history. They would have been in these like boxes with these inscrutable handwriting. And thanks to Jan and our collective efforts, I get to see what he was up to all those years. And it's, I think, pretty magnificent.
And now you get to share it with the world.
Yes, yes.
Well, Michael Ellsberg, it's been just great to talk with you about this really important collection of your father's writings, so necessary to our time, probably to all times, but now even more so. Truth and Consequence. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.